Welcome to the 14th episode of Season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday, the 16th of August, 2010, and in this episode, we're going to talk to COVID Goyal about Calibra. We'll talk to Big Les Pounder and John the Nice Guy Spriggs about an event they're organising. We'll, of course, cover the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, and go over your feedback. I'm Simon, full house this week.
Nearly.
Almost. Except for the person who isn't here.
Okay, who's that?
You remember him?
That's mean. So this week, there's four of us. Tony.
Hello. Hey,
welcome.
All right.
Yeah.
Good.
God, I'm not going to ask you.
You're not going to ask me? All right. Yeah. I've not been doing very much, to be honest.
That's what I wasn't going to ask you. Laura, what have you looked to?
How does that work?
You can only get away with that trick once.
Simon does it every week.
I've been making myself a study by cleaning out the spare room. That's it, really.
An Ubuntu study.
And that's why Tony's not been doing much, because you've been telling him to move all the stuff out of the study.
Yeah. She's been moving everything from where I know it to be to where apparently it should be.
Is that why you've not got any spare cables with you today?
Oh, yes.
Shocking.
No, it's not.
What's the study for? What are you doing with the study?
Studying.
Okay, good. Obvious answer. Move on.
Stupid.
Alan?
I've been doing stuff. I installed a piece of software called Lux.
Sorry, you can't swear on this show.
No. It's not Fing Lux. It's Lux. It's got a dot between the F and the Lux.
Okay.
So you have to have a pause.
Yeah, you have to go Lux. Apparently, it does. I've installed it and I know. It changes the colour temperature of your desktop throughout the day. So that, say, for example, before you go to bed, if you're using your laptop just before you go to bed, the screen will be bright and poking your eyes out because that's the brightness the screen is all the day. It doesn't matter what the background ambient light is like. And so it tries to adjust the temperature dependent upon what your lighting is like and what where you are geographically. So it tries to figure out what time of day it is. You tell it where you are and it figures out what time of day it is and adjusts the color temperature, and you tell it whether you've got fluorescent or halogen lights in the room, and it does change the tint of the screen and makes it dimmer, and it's available for Windows, Mac and Linux.
I got these two buttons on mine. I can
it's not the same. Okay. Because even if you dim it, it's still, if you're looking at a web page, it's still white in your eyes.
Yeah.
And before you go to bed, that's not, you know, kind of very good for you.
So unless you're doing photography or print work where the white balance really matters.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a button where you can turn it off for an hour.
All right.
So while you're doing that kind of work, which is sensitive to, you know, color balance, color temperature, whatever you want to call it, you can press a button and it just switches off.
So it's true then, you do look at Ubuntu with a rose-tinted desktop.
I absolutely do.
All right.
I could install it if I had a workable system.
You could what?
I could install F-Lux if I had a usable system.
Oh, but that sounds bad.
I updated to Maverick
on my
work box.
On your work box?
Well, because you need to get the latest crack and it's great.
And
it won't boot.
Oops.
I only just upgraded my work machine to Lucid last Friday.
Tony will be up to, what is it, Feisty Fawn?
I'm looking forward to Breezy Badger.
And I updated my workbox, and straight away it broke. But luckily I managed to grab Davey, and he said, oh, yeah, there's a fix out. In fact, sent me an email, which I got on the other box, and that fixed it. So I left it a week, and in fact, didn't Jono tweet something about the fact that Maverick was going to break about 4 days ago? And I thought, oh, weekend, it'll be fixed over the weekend. So going to work on a Monday morning, fight the Ubuntu box, update, reboot, fail.
Still fail.
Yeah.
More
teach to listen to Jono.
It's something to do with NVIDIA drivers, and I really do not.
Oh, there's loads of X changes and stuff, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Some of which we'll talk about later.
So don't go to Alpha right now. It's not a good idea.
I use the proprietary drivers.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Well, that doesn't actually help.
Oh.
Right.
That's the intro.
Yeah. Hey, do you know what?
What?
Sounds like a fun back show.
So we're joined on the phone from somewhere in the USA by COVID Goyal, who is the author, maintainer of a product called Calibra. Hello, how are you doing?
Well, first off, it's pronounced as Calibra.
Ah, damn.
I did wonder.
I asked how to pronounce your name and not the product. I'm such an idiot.
Well, you get there.
What is it and what can you do with it?
Well, Calibra is software to manage your ebook collection. You can convert ebooks, you can catalog them, you can view them, you can send them to all the various ebook reader devices. You can also use Calibre to download news from various websites, over 300 at the last count, and convert them into ebooks that you can read on your devices.
Wow.
And it's of particular interest to our listeners because being an Ubuntu podcast, it's available as a deb file for installation on Ubuntu. I think it's in the repositories as well on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Excellent. So how did you get started doing this project? Why did you do it?
Well, way back in 2006 when Sony released the first commercially available ebook reader in the US, which was in, I think, October 2006, it was called the PRS-500. And so I went and got it, I think, in the first week of it being released, because I'm the kind of person who reads a lot. And at the time, I was a grad student at Caltech, and I was living in a single room, and my room was overflowing with books, so I thought ebooks were a pretty good idea. So I went out and I got it. And I'm a long-time Linux since I was about 14. And the ERS-500 sort of used a proprietary USB protocol, and it only worked with Windows. So that was obviously not optimal for me. I decided to reverse engineer that USB protocol to sort of write a small command line tool so that I could, you know, move my books onto the Sony device without having to run a virtual machine or whatever.
Did it come with some Windows-based software already then?
Yeah, it did. It was called the Sony eBook Library software. The software was totally crap anyway. But my original goal was just to, you know, get it working to the point where I could just transfer files from my Linux computer to the device. So I did that, and the original sort of library I wrote to do that was called libprs500.
Nice and specific.
Yes. So it turned out that there was quite a lot of demand for that tool, and there's this wonderful community of ebook enthusiasts called mobilereads.com. There are a lot of people there who were very appreciative of my having written that tool. And as I sort of started using my reader more and more, I discovered that it was really hard to convert books into the LRF format, which was the ebook format that the Sony reader read. Sony had released pretty much no tools to do this, and there were just a few. There was just basically a closed-source Windows ELL that you could sort of use to generate those books. So I decided to write, you know, an open-source tool that could convert common ebook formats to the LRF format.
So was the LRF format proprietary to Sony?
Yes, it was. They had released sort of a, I guess you'd call it a spec for the XML format that LRF is a binary compiled form of, but the binary format itself was not documented anywhere. So they also had to be reverse engineered. Fortunately, there was already a lot of reverse engineering done by people who had used it with the Sony Libri, which was a ebook reader that was available only in Japan sometime before the PRS-500 came to the US. So I used that work to sort of reverse engineer the format and make a converter.
So how long did it take you to go from having just brought the product to having something usable?
Mm-hmm. It took me about, I'd say, about a few months.
Okay, and what sort of...
I used to use Windows to do it, and so then I wrote this software to talk to the device and to convert books to its format. And then eventually, as my collection grew, I decided I needed a sort of, you know, way to manage my books, and so I wrote a graphical user interface that allowed you to manage your books and connect to the device and send them and so on. And that eventually became Calibre.
And what point did you open it up to other contributors, or what point did you make it available?
It was always open source.
Okay, and it's always been cross-platform, or did you started obviously on the platform that you use on Windows and Linux, but I noticed it's available for Mac, Windows, and Linux. Well, did you do all the porting yourself? Did you get help, or was it?
Yeah, I did all the porting myself. So when I was at Caltech, one of my part-time job was being a sysadmin. So I was familiar with all the major platforms because, you know, you have to debug people's computers. So it wasn't too much of a challenge for me to port it to the various platforms.
Well, it sounds like you've obviously got a plenty of motivation for finishing it off and a little bit of free time, which helps to get through to the end of it.
Yeah, so I started doing this in 2006 and I graduated in 2009. So, you know, those 3 years I had a lot of free time. And for the last year I've been working full-time on Calibre because it's just that. big.
So has this been funded by anybody, any companies or donations?
No, it's purely donations-based and ads on the website.
Oh, excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know.
It's funny because I've recently purchased an Amazon Kindle, and I've been using your software to send books to it, and also I found the ability to scrape the news from various websites and put that on the Kindle is very useful. Did you do all of the code for that, or was that contributed by the people? How did you get that kind of community working?
There's a story behind how the news downloading code made it into Gulliver. So what happened was that I used to subscribe to Newsweek, which is a sort of weekly news magazine, uh-huh. and it used to be delivered to my apartment, you know, once a week. But for some reason, the deliveries stopped, and I spent a lot of time on the phone trying to get them to restart the deliveries, but it was hopeless. So I said, you know, let me fix this by writing code to download the website into an ebook format and read it on my reader. So that's how it started. And yes, I wrote the initial code to do that. And of course, there have been contributions from various people over the years to improve it and add features to it.
Has it been easy to transfer that onto other websites, other news websites?
So Gulliver has a very nice system, even though I shouldn't be saying it since I designed it myself. But it's something called Recipes. So a recipe is basically a 10 or 15 line Python script that tells the Gulliver news download system, you know, what are the particular features of the website in question. And so just with over 10 or 15 lines of code, you can create a recipe to download news from any given website. And so the vast majority of recipes in Gulliver today, there are, I think, over 300 now, were contributed by users.
So what version of Gulliver are you up to now? What's the latest version?
I think it's 0.7.14.
Wow.
I make a release every week, so it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I find myself, every time I open it, there's an update to do. And it amazes me how you manage to keep on top of all these updates. And there's, in the notes, it's clear that you're, you know, fixing bugs and adding support for readers and adding support for websites. So you said this was a full-time job. Is that, you survive basically on the donations from the software?
Yes, the donations from Gulliver users are actually enough for me to quit my day job. I actually earn a little bit more than I would have if I continued being a physicist. I'm not saying a lot because physicists don't earn much, but, you know.
That's pretty impressive. Do you think that's partly down to the fact that you've embedded the little donate button in the software? That
about 30% of donations are from that button, the rest are from the website.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
And yeah, when I first did it, I had negative feedback from a lot of people in the open source community because most open source software does not do that. But it's been an important part of sort of making Gulliver sustainable.
And do you find many people repeat donate, or are these new donations every time?
It's about 8.5% of donors have donations.
Okay.
One of the things that struck me when I installed it, and I haven't used it because I don't have an ebook reader, was just how slick it looked. It was really obvious to me how I was going to use it, because I downloaded it when I was looking at getting a Sony reader and I wanted to know how it would be supported. Did you do all the design work yourself, or have you worked with other people, and was it for you that you wanted it to be easy to use and graphical, or was that because other people inputted their ideas?
So I always wanted a graphical user interface.
Okay.
So I'm the kind of person who loves to use command line interfaces. For example, I use Mutt to read my email. I do all my coding in Vim. But for certain things, I find graphical user interfaces are useful, particularly when you're browsing long lists of things, like a list of, you know, books in your library.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to make it graphical. And one of the things I've noticed about ebook readers in general is that they tend to be used very often by older people.
Right.
People who are who read a lot and who may not be that comfortable with computers. So one of my goals was to, you know, make it simple enough to use that, you know, people who are relatively less comfortable with computers could also use it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did do the design of the user interface myself, but that design has evolved over the years based on feedback from users.
Cool. I love the big buttons on it. You just don't get that very often.
It has changed.
Yeah, a lot of people tell me, you know, get rid of the big buttons. They usually tend to be fellow software designers. But, you know, feedback I've got from people, from actual users, seems to suggest that the big buttons help a new user to figure out how to, you know, get started.
Yeah.
So how easy was it to incorporate support for a variety of other ebook readers? Is there a common standard, or do they all do things differently?
So most ebook readers do things differently, but it's helped by the fact that almost all ebook readers are sort of expose themselves as USB disks when you connect them to the computer. So what Calibre does is it uses that. It recognizes the device based on its USB IDs, and then it just uses it in disk mode. And just like the system I described for recipes, I have a system of drivers. So you can basically, each device driver is another 10, 15 lines of code.
So each one has to be added individually, but doing so is relatively trivial. Is that right?
Yes. So I have a sort of entry in the Calibre FAQ telling users that if you want this device supported, you know, run so and so command on your system, it should give me the information I need to add the driver for the device to Calibre.
And because you release so often, it's presumably quite easy to push that out into the next version the following week.
Yes. That is one of the reasons I release so often. It's because the ebook space is growing and changing really rapidly, so to keep up with it, it's important to have a quick release cycle.
I've noticed one of my coworkers has a Sony e-reader, and I mentioned your software to her, and she said, "Oh yeah, I already use that," and actually she'd already donated to you as well, which kind of surprised me in a way that A, she was already using it, and B, she'd already donated. I don't know why I was so surprised, but it made me wonder: do you have some kind of deal with ebook providers, or how is it you're getting the word out there? Because it seems that everyone who has an ebook reader knows it.
It's purely word of mouth.
Really?
Wow.
Yep. Well, it's been around for 4 years now, so, you know, I was lucky in that I caught the ebook wave right at the beginning. And so now, you know, you go to any ebook forum, you go to, you know, help sites, everybody recommends Calibre to sort of new users as a way to accomplish tasks that the standard software from the big companies doesn't allow them to do.
Mm.
So what does it do apart from things like the news site scraping and stuff that the bundled software wouldn't do typically?
Well, the conversions. One of the big... Now it's becoming less of a problem because there are now only two major ebook formats, EPUB and Mobi. But at the beginning, there were a lot. There was PDB, there was LRF, there was EPUB, there was Mobi. And then there are people who have books in legacy formats like Rocketbook and simple text files and so on. So Calibre allows you to convert between all those formats. And also, you know, if you have your own documents, not just, you know, novels that you buy, but documents of your own that you'd like to read on your book reader, then you can use Calibre to get them into a form that's suitable.
And there's, am I right in saying there's one format that you currently don't convert, and that's the Amazon Kindle DRM?
No, Calibre converts both from and to... the format itself. It does not convert DRM formats because that would be illegal. But the format itself does convert.
Is that a legal consideration for you distributing software in the United States, or is that?
Yes, the DMCA makes it illegal to distribute software that circumvents copyright protection mechanisms.
But if someone else distributed a plugin for your software, and they just
there actually outside. Are plugins that remove.
Well, that's interesting to know.
Yes, well.
Does the same apply for things like the DRM on EPUB and that format?
Yes.
All right. Okay.
So EPUB actually has several types of DRM. So there's one from Adobe, there's one that Barnes and Noble uses, and there's one that Apple uses. So I haven't really kept up with, you know, the state of DRM removal and all those various things. But sure. I know that for at least some of them, there are plugins that remove it.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So
For anyone who has an ebook reader or is interested in getting involved in the project, what's the best place for them to get in contact with you?
So there's a get involved section on the website. It has detailed instructions on how to get started. The user manual has a section on how to set up a development environment for Calibre on all the various platforms that it supports.
And what programming languages is it written in?
Calibre is written in Python, C, C++, JavaScript, mostly Python.
Cool. Great. Well, thanks very much for joining us. Yeah. And good luck with the future endeavors of your fantastic software.
Thanks very much indeed.
Good luck.
My pleasure.
It's time for the news and events.
Database behemoth Oracle, who recently brought Sun and with it MySQL and Java, have sued the makers of the Android mobile operating system, Google. Oracle claim that Google are infringing 7 software patents by not using the Oracle version of Java.
Mm.
And so it begins.
Yeah.
So everyone calls them Scoracle now.
Yes.
Right. Well, this is a seg on its own, but I'm going to say, so what?
Really? That's our two-word,
well,
the UUPC opinion.
Well, look, you know, we aim to everybody. So what? For the average Joe? Yeah, and?
Yeah, for the average Joe, it probably doesn't mean anything. There's going to be lots of lawyers fighting over this.
Yeah, and?
For some considerable time, no doubt.
Yeah, and then one day they'll pick on a little guy.
The Free Software Foundation is trying to tackle the barriers faced by women wanting to get involved in FLOSS, such as the shortage of female role models and isolating or sexist behaviour from parts of the community. What do you think, Laura?
I'm on the spot.
As a spokesperson for your people.
For people.
For your race.
What do you people think?
Makes a lot of sense.
There we go.
That was worth redoing, wasn't it?
Spoken for my people. It makes sense having role models and things. It encourages you.
It actually seems to be one of the things the FSF, a positive thing that FSF are doing. Of all the, you know, I've had a go at the FSF over the years, for all the negative stuff.
That was really wonderful.
This actually seems like a good idea.
No, I mean, I read this when it was out the other day, and I just thought it was a really good study they've done.
Meanwhile, the Linux Foundation have announced the Orwellian-sounding Open Compliance Program, which will provide tools and education to help companies meet their obligations to the provisions of the various open-source licenses they use.
Blimey. Yeah. Isn't this what Simon Phipps was doing at opensource.org or whatever they call
it? Open Source Institute.
That's it,
the OSI.
Open Source Institute. Yeah.
I don't think so, or if it is, it's
kind of putting something similar.
Well, I mean, there was, I think it was Bradley Coon from the SFLC, that's the one I was going for, sort of said, well, he hopes this puts him out of business, really, and then it helps companies actually do the right thing in the first place, rather than have to hit them with threats of lawsuits or whatever, because they've released some GPL binary and haven't set the source code alongside it.
SparkleShare, a file sharing and synchronization tool like Dropbox and Ubuntu One, has made its 0.2 Alpha 2 release. Is this news? Using an SSH backend, it can sync files between multiple computers and users and even retains version history.
I guess the reason why this is news, even though it is like 0.000, you know, release 0, it's it has the promise of being an open source Dropbox and Ubuntu One.
Okay.
Whereas neither of those are fully open source.
Fair enough. It's got a cool name.
SparkleShare. Mm. It is. Mm. It is very pony-like, yes.
Covered in glitter.
Yeah.
But it's got an SSH backend, which could be quite useful for those who like to dabble with command.
I think they're trying to build it using, you know, the kind of open-y tools and protocols and stuff, which kind of makes sense, really.
Yeah. You can run your own server, or you can choose one of a couple of other services, sort of hosted services.
Ah, that's nice.
Nice.
Home server.
I think it's very, given by the version number, it's very early in the development.
I
don't think there are any releases, as in you can't get a deb yet. There might be some people who put it in a PPA, but at the moment it's fairly early.
It's full of sparkle and promise.
The BBC have announced plans to support iPlayer on Android later in the year, as well as promising to support HTML5, despite worries about the ratification process.
This is good.
The reason they haven't made it available on Android at the moment, apparently, is because of the lack of DRM on Android.
Well, that's just not true, really, is it? Given there's no DRM on the iPhone, and they provide a special version of iPlayer for the iPhone.
Ah, you're calling the BBC out?
Well, it's been the case for ages that the iPlayer brand is used to cover, you know, a number of things, the Flash thing, the Adobe Airbase download thing.
Yeah.
And for ages, there's been a version specifically for Apple's devices.
QuickTime movies, basically.
And it's QuickTime MP4s, and there's no DRM on that.
Yeah.
Which is what the Get iPlayer script used to monopolize and enable you to download the MP4 files, MOV files or whatever they are, and play them on a Linux desktop.
But it does sound rather like they're developing an Android app that will have some sort of DRM or encryption or rights management of some sort in there.
It's completely mental. Why can't they just serve up video that an Android phone would be able to play back out the box?
The oldie first-person shooter game Return to Castle Wolfenstein has been released under the GPL. Although there's not a native port for Linux yet, perhaps it will appear in the Ubuntu Software Center before too long.
It's a great game. It was.
It was a great game. I'm not sure I could really be bothered to sit and play it for too long.
Really?
These days.
Why not?
Well, okay, my...
Did you have it in the past? Did you ever play it? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And sort of Doom on the network and things back in the day.
No, it's much newer than that. This is not Castle Wolfenstein, the one where you could only go left and
left and right,
forward through doors
and sideways.
Yeah, no, it's not that one.
Sideways.
This is based on a Quake engine. It's a fairly recent game.
Then I probably didn't play it.
And based on that, there was a game called Enemy Territory
terrible.
And was multiplayer online, and that had a Linux version.
Actually, it was really good, which is why it was terrible.
Terrible for the social life.
Absorbed all your time.
That's right.
Yeah, it's totally brilliant.
Yeah, the Lug Radio team used to have a server, didn't they?
Yep.
Sunday nights.
Yeah.
Great fun.
Well, it is nearly 10 years since Return to Castle Wolfenstein came out.
Come to Manchester on Saturday, the 28th of August, for U-Cubed, which is
John Spriggs and Big Les Pounder.
Which is what we're going to talk to them about in a couple of minutes. We've had this message from Laura Tchaikovsky about Os Bar Camp.
Hello, this is Tchaikovsky here, she's at TAB here in Ireland, just to let you know about the OSS Bar Camp happening in Dublin on Saturday and Sunday the 25th and 26th of September, happening in the University College of Dublin. There'll be lots of stuff happening. Stefan from the Debian lead is coming over to give a talk, as are you lovely fellows, and he'll be doing a live show. There's a programming competition on, and tons of talks from lots of cool people, so hope to see you all over here soon.
The special news is that we are going to be there.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing a live show, a live recording of some sort, and we're going to be giving some talks.
Oh, yeah.
At the moment, me, Dave, and Alan are going along.
Yep.
And
Should be good fun.
Should be good fun.
Organised by Laura CZ Tan.
Yep. Have you got any idea what we're going to do in our show yet?
Not a clue. It's far too far in the future. We don't know what we're doing in this show, let alone one that's weeks ahead.
But go along to the Os Bar Camp website, and then you can find out how to register and come along and see us make idiots of ourselves yet again.
There's a Floss UK Unconference on the 16th of October in Birmingham.
Yep, and the Ubuntu Global Jam is on its way. Alan, when is the Ubuntu Global Jam happening?
It's on the weekend of the 28th of August.
Cool, and it's an opportunity for people to get involved in some sort of a project, so maintaining some documentation or looking for bugs or reporting bugs or something like that.
Yep, and also an opportunity for people to get information on how to get involved. So, you know, come along, there'll be other people there who already know how to do things like file bugs, triage bugs, and...
So this is people getting physically together in the same room?
Yeah, it can be. I know some places they're doing it via IRC, and other places they've got a venue and they can turn up and all sit around with laptops and hack away on Ubuntu.
Places like Hackerspace London, anybody know if they're going to be there?
I don't know.
That's a good suggestion, actually. Mm. We should get on to them.
Another idea.
So how do you get involved with this one?
We'll put a link in the show notes, and you just organise your own event. It's very easy to do. You just add an event to the loco directory and tell everyone about it and get a few people together.
And Software Freedom Day is coming up. The UK looks more covered this year than perhaps last year, but there's still a bit of a gap in Northern Ireland and the southwest of England and the east of England. So if you're in those regions, get involved, get yourself a team, and do some promotion, do some advocacy.
And when is it?
I don't know, it doesn't say.
18th of September.
18th
I knew that, really. I was just using that as a device.
That's my Twitter birthday.
Your what?
My Twitter birthday.
Oh, dear. So we've gone from you never view any websites unless they're posted to you on Twitter to having a Twitter birthday.
Everyone's got a Twitter birthday.
Oh, dear.
I don't care. Let's move on. That was the end of the event. On the line this evening, we've got Les Pounder and John Spriggs. Evening, gentlemen.
Hi there. Good evening.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Not too bad, thanks.
Good, good. Now, you're going to talk to us about this event that you're running, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so what's it called, when is it, and where, and what, and why, and how?
Let's see, it's U-Cubed, which is an Ubuntu on conference, which also has upstream elements to it. By upstream, I mean Debian. It's going to be on the 28th of August, which is a Saturday, starting at 11 a.m. at MadLab in Manchester.
Okay, cool. So what sort of venue is MadLab?
That's a good question. It's like a community centre for the geeks, the technology-interested people, and the artists of Manchester. Groups like Hackman, which is the Manchester Hackspace, and Manlug meet there on a regular basis. And it's a great site for technology events, and they're basically letting us use the space for this, what we hope is going to be a great event.
Cool. And it's billed as it's on the same weekend coinciding with the Ubuntu Global Jam, which we've mentioned previously, and there's upstream stuff in there, and it's an unconference. So what kind of stuff do you expect to be happening at this event?
Obviously, it's an unconference. Oh, it's like an unconference. It's an unworkshop. You know, unconferences, sometimes known as bar camps, or in your case, an odd camp. It's obviously where people turn up in the morning, and there's no fixed schedule to what's going to happen through the day.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're hoping is we're going to apply the same principles to the unworkshop. People turn up in the morning and say, I want to do a workshop on bug reporting because I have no idea how to do it and I want somebody to help me go through it.
Oh, cool.
You know, if they turn up and say, I'm fluent in gibberish, which seems to be what I'm doing, then, you know, I want to do a translation. And somebody, if anyone's there that knows about translations, like you have with a normal unconference, you pick a slot, you say when you're going to be talking, and you have people turn up and work through it with you.
So have you any idea yet as to how many people are going to turn up? Have you got anybody actually lined up to come and sort of do the, I suppose the hardest one is the initial guy to stand up and kick the whole conference off.
That's going to be John. I'm going to be standing at the front going, it's all my fault, come and kick me.
So that'll be a good start then. It'll be fun.
We're hoping to get around about We've been told that we can only have 60 people on site, so
people need to get their tickets soon.
Well, indeed, and people may be thinking, oh, 60 tickets, they're all bound to have gone, you know, I'm never going to get a ticket. Well, we've got a waiting list, and the 60 is a very loose figure. We were given that figure when we were first pitching it to MadLab as an event for the day. They've now said that we've got a little bit more room, so we have got a little bit of stretch.
Cool.
So if you go and try and get your ticket, and you get told we're sold out, keep going through. There's a waiting list you can add yourself to.
Oh, okay.
And hopefully, you know, if we don't go massively over numbers, then we'll still be able to invite you along, even though you might have crossed the end of the.
You have to put tables out in the streets.
Well, there's a bar just across the road, so if we're really pushed, we can always.
Which is not a bad idea. Not a bad idea to get people, you know, outside in and all that malarkey. So, what kind of you've got Ubuntu stuff like you said, like how do I report bugs or how do I translate stuff? And you mentioned that it's going to be upstream stuff as well. What's the motivation for doing upstream stuff as well? What are you planning to do there?
Actually, this one was inspired by your good selves.
Oh dear.
Well, in your episode, season 3, episode 12, County Fair, you interviewed a guy called Joe Shields.
Yes.
And he was saying how he contributes both to the Ubuntu project, but also predominantly at the moment, the Debian project, because he knows that it filters down into the Ubuntu project.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why we've said it's upstream as well is we want to kind of drive home to people that there is so much stuff that's going on upstream from Ubuntu in projects like Debian that we just want to make sure that, A, people recognize that work, and we give them an opportunity to contribute not only to Ubuntu, but to the Debian project as well. And that was really important to us.
And that gives you three U's as well.
Ironically, the three U's came up after we decided we were going to have the event. So it was just kind of like, we need a catchy title, and U-Cubed was it.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and apparently U2 was taken.
Yeah, you just get mistaken for an aging rock group.
Yes, and you've got a mailing list as well. So if people want to join in offline, I guess if they're not able to get to Manchester, but they want to join in and help out or learn stuff, I guess the mailing list is there. Are you going to have IRC, maybe webcam, audio, that kind of stuff?
We're not 100% certain about what upstream connectivity we're going to have yet. I mean, it is effectively a technology community centre. So we don't realistically know how much upstream connectivity we're going to have. We are going to have things like apt mirrors, theoretically, on site and things like that. And there will be some upstream, connectivity for, you know, showing people around Launchpad if they want to know about that sort of thing. I think, realistically, having people on IRC on the day possibly is going to be a bit of a stretch, but yeah, the mailing list is definitely a really good place to get involved.
One thing we found at the UDS conferences, in order to get inclusion from people outside who weren't at the venue, was to have a projector just projecting an IRC channel on the wall, and that way anyone in the room could see external people wanting to ask questions of the people in the room or wanting to, you know, get involved and that kind of stuff. And you can, you know, very easily participate remotely, that kind of thing.
Actually, that's a really cool idea. Let's stick it on the to-do list.
Brilliant.
I've got a bit of a question. You talked about having people coming along saying, maybe I want to learn how to do bugs or I want to help with the translation. Have you got experts there who are going to be able to help people do that sort of thing? Have you got, you know, known gurus lined up?
We hope so. I'm not going to mention any names as yet.
Okay, fair enough.
That's
somebody
the best
from
way.
The Ubuntu, somebody from Canonical has said that they're going to try and be there.
Excellent.
But obviously, if he can't make it, I don't want everyone in the community to turn around and sort of stab him the next time they see him.
Oh,
that would just be unfair.
Yeah, but fun.
Well, you know, it's a weekend. It's people's, you know, free time. So
sure.
Yeah, you have to be lucky to get people sometimes.
Well, indeed, and unfortunately, it actually also conflicts with the Debian UK barbecue, which has made us incredibly unpopular with the Debian community. At the moment.
So, how's that mission of bringing us together as two communities working out?
Well, we only found out about it when we started advertising, which was a bit embarrassing.
Well, if anything, it's a good way to try out the event and learn from, you know, scheduling and getting an event location and remote participation. And if anything, it may well give you motivation to do another one and next time speak to the Debian people and make sure they're not having a barbecue on the same day.
I mean, this event's good practice as well for us because there's the 10.10 release party in Manchester.
Ah, yes.
So this will give us ideas on how we can make it better.
Yeah.
And you're organising that as well, are you?
Oh, go on then, yeah. I did
volunteer convinced. On the mailing list, so yeah, I think I'm probably quite heavily involved in that now.
Magic.
Excellent.
And that's on a Sunday as well.
Yeah,
well,
it is.
Could be on a Sunday. The release day's on a Sunday, but...
yeah.
Well, I did the last one as well. I organised that, so...
See, lots of cool open source stuff happening, not in London.
Yeah, that's really great. This is one thing that we get complaints all the time about organising, well, we in the Ubuntu community, not necessarily us, but about organising events in London. And the thing that we keep saying is, if you want something outside London, organise it. Just go and do it. And that's what John and Les have done, is just go ahead and do it. And that's what you need to do.
That's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant stuff. So where can people find out more about your event?
Well, we were quite aware of the fact that the URLs that we picked don't really translate very well to podcasts. So the mailing list, I'll give you that one first because that's a slightly longer one.
Oh.
We've put that at tinyurl.com/ucubedlist. That's UCUBEDLIST, and that's all one word.
Good stuff.
And then the actual Eventbrite ticket page, which is where we're distributing the tickets from, is again tinyurl/ucubed, C-U-B-E-D.
Nice one.
Brilliant.
And there are currently 41 tickets remaining, it says.
Yeah, but but don't expect those to be around for much longer.
Indeed. Well, good luck with it, and we'll speak to you after the event about telling us how fantastic it was.
Thanks very much.
Indeed, have fun with it.
Thank you, good luck. Bye.
And it's time for a bit of Ubuntu.
Good.
See, it sounds all right when Laura does it.
What are you saying?
It just sounds annoying when you do it.
Well,
no, it's just because I feel affronted that I'm not allowed to call it Ecosphere. See how I got that in there.
Ballora. Yeah, you Laura think you get away.
It's all in the edit.
Yeah. All right, what's the first bit this time?
Ubuntu 10.10 has hit feature freeze.
No more features.
Chilly.
At all, ever?
Chilly features.
Well, for 10.10.
Well, so it's not so long away now, is it?
No, it's not. October the 10th.
Yeah, but a couple of months.
We're mid-August. Feature freeze right now.
Yeah, now it's all about bug fixing, testing, getting it all working.
Yeah, getting it to boot.
How is that a booting experience on your work laptop?
So they should have all the major features done now. They're just sort of polishing before the release. Good fixing. Stuff.
There's a lengthy thread on the Ubuntu Devil mailing list about the application review board.
Gripping. What's it all about, Alan?
Well, the application review board, there's this idea that we can get apps into Ubuntu after the release has been made. Because normally, once a release is made, no new apps go into that release.
Okay.
Other than via PPAs or via backports from a future release.
So this is quite relevant to LTSs and things?
We're talking about this for Maverick onwards. Not for past releases. So we're testing the process, but there's a bit of a lengthy discussion about how that process should work and whether the process definition was done well by the technical board and by the development teams and Canonical themselves.
Does it risk distracting developer and developer time from the new distros and putting that effort into making newer applications available for older distro releases?
Potentially, yeah. It's worth reading, though, to get an idea of what the plans are for getting new apps. I think the example scenario that Rick Spencer gives is, say, for example, someone working for a large movie studio creates a screensaver for the latest film, and they want to get that screensaver into Ubuntu.
Right.
Normally, they have to wait 6 months for the next release for it to go through the normal review process. And the idea is, how can you get that thing in, which is very time sensitive because the movie's about to come out. How do you get that into the repository or into a repository somehow so that it can appear very quickly on the Ubuntu desktop of your users?
Link in the show notes?
Yes.
Excellent. There's a new hardware certification website, which is very impressive.
Yeah, apparently it's not that new, but
none
of us knew about it.
Well, it may, Well, maybe you should go and check it out if you've not seen it, because it is very impressive.
Yeah.
It has a list of various bits of hardware from lots of manufacturers. I mean, big tier one manufacturers. And the hardware that is either certified with Ubuntu or known to work well with Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm. Ubuntu enabled, Ubuntu ready, or...
Yeah. And it also lists... based on the distribution, so you can see that 606 back in the day, one or two pieces of hardware supported, but the 10.04 LTS has a lot more, sort of 20 plus 14 plus 18 total, is it? Okay,
yes. Trying to do the maths while you were talking.
All right, okay. I was trying to do it at the same time, but I can multitask. Not very well. But yeah, so it's really gratifying to see hardware manufacturers helping us support Ubuntu on all these different models of laptop. And perhaps if you're looking to buy a laptop or a netbook or a desktop, check out the hardware certified website.
Do you know the interesting thing is, you know how much we in the community have moaned about the fact that Dell do or don't sell their machines via their website? Look at how many laptops, desktops, servers, and netbooks that are certified to run with Ubuntu. The hardware does work. It's just really painful to get hold of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between selling it with Ubuntu and certifying it to work with Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
The technical board have agreed to the removal of the IA64 and Spark ports of Ubuntu Server for future releases. I think they asked for help and nobody gave any.
Yeah, I think they were looking for people to take over maintainership of Itanium and Spark, and it seems there isn't that much call for it.
Reply, there was none. Well, so if you've got an old piece of Sun hardware or something, you might be out of luck running Ubuntu Server on it in the future, and you're going to be out of luck running OpenSolaris on it in the future as well.
Well, the good news is it's an LTS release that has just gone. So
you've got 5 years.
You've got some time yet before you have to
upgrade to an AMD 64 machine.
Canonical has started tracking Ubuntu installations by providing a package called Canonical-Census, which sends an I am alive ping to Canonical daily.
Yes. This has got a bit of a brouhaha. Yeah.
Of course it has.
It's the same thing that Smoothwall did 10 years ago and caused the same brouhaha.
Really?
But what is the brouhaha? Basically. I mean, what's the big deal? Is
well, it people just don't like ping?
You're stealing my data, you're stealing my privacy.
Yeah, you're identifying me.
Get a life.
By installing
it's
this
a ping.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is that they could potentially see where that ping came from and, you know, potentially track, you know.
The problem is that goes into your wall, the cable. Yeah, we'll pull that out. That's secure. That's nice and secure.
Yeah, it's only partly secure. But yeah, that's it. I mean, it's an optional package, so nobody's forcing you to install it.
And in fact, you won't get it installed anyway because it's only on OEM installs.
Okay.
The idea is that companies like Dell want to know that when they sell a machine with Ubuntu, they want to know whether that machine continues to be running Ubuntu or whether people somebody's wipe it and put something else on it.
A dirty copy of Windows.
It is positive.
Hmm. And it's very cunning the way they've written the code, and it's explained in various posts by various very clever developers.
You can manually add a pin on the map if you want to, though, I think.
No, that's something separate as well.
Ooh, that's yes. Something separate.
So did you say we're not going to be able to install this? Only going to come on OEMs?
It will be on some OEM machines by default, okay. Yes. But not. It won't be in on the Ubuntu CD that okay. You get.
But it's going to be in the repository so that I can go and install it on all my boxes.
I don't know. Chances are it will probably be in the partner repository and not in the main archive.
But available if we want to.
I'm sure you could install. I mean, it is hosted on Launchpad. There's a bazaar branch. So if you wanted to go and get it and count yourself in, you could well do that. But
one way of, you know,
I'm not sure it's much use.
It's kind of pointless.
It is, because it's aimed for the OEMs to be able to determine how many of this model of laptop are there still out there running Ubuntu. That's what it's after. That's what they're after, that
but
data.
It could be used for some rather nice Ubuntu stats.
Well, not really, because the data all goes to Canonical, and whether they're going to release that data or not, who knows at the moment.
Still good for gathering
but they also,
stats.
But they also don't know the overall number of potential users that could have it running. Like with the OEMs, they know what the starting figure is, and then they can see how many there are left over.
Yeah, I mean, they get there's a sale, so obviously it makes it easier to know what the starting figure is. But for, you know, CDs you pass around, you've got no idea.
Yeah.
We've had a voicemail from a guy called Mark talking about multi-touch.
Well, I do love the background music and the intro music. Hello, everybody. It's Mark Shuttleworth speaking, just calling to say hello to the Ubuntu UK podcast crowd and audience. I hope you're all doing brilliantly well. I am calling to speak very briefly about the multi-touch work that just landed. 10.10 is going to absolutely rock if you have a touch screen which can do four-finger touch, or if you have any kind of separate magic trackpad or touchpad which has multi-finger touch. We had an integration meeting where we brought all these bits together last week. It wasn't clear that we were going to have them ready for 10.10, so we hadn't been talking about it, but everything came together brilliantly. And by the end of the week, we had huge smiles all around, and everybody said that this completely changed the way they want to interact with their netbooks and laptops and desktops. So I think that's the future. I'm delighted that we'll get a little glimpse of it first in free.
First in free? What? if you know what Mark was going to say next, leave us a voicemail.
The Ubuntu UK podcast voicemail system is a respecter of no man.
You get 1 minute and that's it.
Yeah, no waffle from anyone.
Right, thanks for leaving us the message there, Mark. It's great to know the inside track on what's going on with that. Yeah, sounds absolutely. Very exciting, actually.
It does.
That's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time.
It's time for some of your feedback.
Nick Thorley is worried about Alan putting Ubuntu on his MacBook.
Oh, nice concern.
I wanted to ask whether it's safe. I read an article a while back that said putting Linux on a Mac can kill the hardware. They said that on PC-based laptops, the control of the temperature, fans, CPU speed, etc. is controlled by a chip on the board and will automatically adjust based on the feedback the module receives. However, on a Mac, this feedback is done by software, and hence, if Linux is put on the machine, this feedback doesn't occur, and it can lead to overheating and CPU running a lot harder than it needs to. Because of this, they cited Linux on Mac as being a machine killer. Do you know about this, and what are your thoughts on it? Is it Apple fan propaganda or valid reasoning?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, it is a potential issue, because the Mac hardware is a bit quirky in places. But the good news is there's a few wiki pages that detail what the issues are and how to work around them or how to fix them.
Okay, so it's not entirely FUD then?
No, there are. I mean, well, one of the problems is that...
it's a Mac.
Yeah, there is a specific bit of code that manages the fan control on Macs. So, yeah, if you did a vanilla install, I don't know, maybe the fans wouldn't turn on or they'd be on all the time. I don't mm-hmm. know. But there is workarounds or fixes for that kind of stuff.
I mean, you use it on yours and is it all right? It doesn't. The fan's not always whirring the whole time?
Not
when
really
I... Put on it. He just has it installed.
Shut up, leave me alone.
In my experience, it seems to work okay.
Cool. Okay. Well, it's worth checking out that wiki page then.
I follow the documentation.
What's the URL?
help.ubuntu.com/community/MacBook Pro.
Cool. Well, check it out before you install it on your MacBook Pro.
I will.
Not you, the listeners.
Oh, you mean them? Yes.
Too late for you. Ian McCalloon wrote a very, very, very long email which started like this.
I want to thank you all for the incredible amount of time and energy that you put into the podcast. It really is appreciated and helped me no end as I've got used to using Ubuntu. Over the last couple of episodes, you've discussed how to bring new users into the Linux and Ubuntu fold. So for what it's worth, here's my story.
And he went on to tell us about discovering Linux and installing it on an old HP laptop.
Once I actually got a properly working system, I could start trying to get used to this weird world of repositories. I've been used to downloading an .exe file and installing a program like that. None of this ferreting around with Synaptic. It was clear that I had much to learn, so I'm glad I chose Ubuntu for the helpful community. From an outsider's perspective, the world of Linux seems to be inhabited either by beardy zealots or by ghastly kids who think references to $M or Windows with a Z and wind blows is somehow smart or amusing. Maybe they are if you're a kid, but not to an old fart like me.
Nice.
Join the club. This is one of the reasons I love your show. The content is great. The chemistry is there between you all. You cover free and open source issues without zealotry and accept that not everything produced by Microsoft is a pile of poo. It's fun. It's a fun show to listen to. I couldn't ever imagine listening to a Windows podcast, but you make the world of Ubuntu really engaging. I think I'll always have at least one Microsoft system in the house, if only for my son's PC games. But everything else will be Ubuntu, thanks in part to the Ubuntu UK podcast.
Aww.
Wow, that's a really nice email. Thank you very much indeed for sending that in.
It was a lovely mail, actually, very long, but it was we all read all of it. It was lovely. Yes. So thank you.
We haven't got time to read it all out on the show, unfortunately, but emails like that really do kind of help us keep motivated, and it's good to know that people are listening and enjoying the show.
People actually listen.
They don't just download it.
Yeah, download it and keep it forever.
Roger Light picked us up on something from the last episode.
In the Country Fair, at some point you were talking about pretty grub splash screens and also how it's a shame that we can't turn on a Linux computer without having a black screen and a blinking cursor. I'm sure you know roughly where this is going. OpenSUSE has had both of these features for years. Probably. I did have to check there wasn't a blinking cursor before writing this. I was always surprised at how ugly the grub menu appeared on Ubuntu compared to other systems I've used.
Yeah, I know one of our friends, Rob, goes on about how lovely the Fedora boot screen is.
He does.
And has been for a long time.
Yeah, even some of the sort of embedded Linux distros like IPCOP and stuff had a nice boot splash screen, and it was supposed to be on a system that you never saw boot. So Ubuntu is quite far behind the curve on this. But yeah, well, it's good to know that some people are there. Hopefully we'll see a nice, pretty grub splash screen in the next release.
Mm. Peter Cannon mailed in with some feedback about the language used on Planet Ubuntu.
While I cannot speak any foreign language whatsoever myself, that does not stop me having followers on Twitter and Identica. I also subscribe to a fair few planets that do host foreign language blogs. I can't read them, but if I spot a word or an image that looks interesting, I can always use one of those online translators such as Babelfish. My point is, I think it's wrong to say that you can only post in a given language. There are bound to be people who want to get their observations, experiences and comments out to the Ubuntu community, yet are not allowed to by virtue of language. And isn't that a form of discrimination? To misquote a Star Trek phrase by Spock, the needs of one outweigh the needs of many.
Apparently so.
Yep.
It's a fair point. And I think when we were talking about this, we did kind of indicate that it might be an idea to have a mix, or how it would be technically.
We did as well.
I don't think we dismissed it out of hand.
I think we said that that's what had been agreed previously.
What has been agreed now is in the last community council meeting, actually. I don't know if we mentioned this last time. Alan Bell and some other people are going to get together and create a more language aware planet.
Oh.
And maybe put a demo site up for us to have a look at and evaluate and figure if it's worth replacing Planet Ubuntu.
Oh, cool. That's a really good idea. So can people get in touch with Alan Bell to put their foreign language blogs on it?
At the moment, I don't know what the state is, but okay. We'll get him to give us a voicemail and let us know. Yeah.
Give us a ring, Alan, and let us know.
John Joyce has a question for us.
When I tried to open a saved web page transferred from a USB flash drive using a computer at a public library running Windows XP and Internet Explorer onto a home computer with Ubuntu or another Linux distribution installed, I often am unable to. Instead, I get a dialog box with the options run in terminal, cancel, display, and run. Usually if the page opens, it appears to be in code. This is not useful. This problem is preventing me from installing Ubuntu 10.4 as my main OS, and this has been the case since Ubuntu 7.04. And indeed, it's prevented me from recommending Ubuntu wholeheartedly to others. I do not have the internet access at home. What else do I need to do?
It's interesting because he's, you know, we kind of make assumptions that, you know, if you've got a computer, you'll have internet access. And he's clearly having to transport documents to and from between a public access computer and his machine at home.
Sneakernet,
indeed.
As we used to call it in the 80s.
Yes, yes. Never underestimate the bandwidth of a lorry load of tapes.
Yeah. The latency is very, very high, but the
bandwidth is huge.
Bandwidth is huge.
So he has a specific issue there, a techie issue. We don't usually get technical questions.
We don't, and we're not always in the best position to answer it. But I have had a look at the screenshots that he emailed us, and it looks as if, John, you're trying to save or you're saving the files on Windows as .mht files, which I think is a Microsoft kind of format.
Oh, that's the default in Internet Explorer when you go File, Save, Page As.
Yeah, so you'd have more luck trying to save them as HTML file format. So if you go File, Save As and look for something that says HTML, And you'll end up with one file that is your page and then a folder with all the other files that are related to that page in that. If you copy them both onto your USB stick, you should then be able to open them file open in Firefox. Alternatively, there is an extension called UnMHT for Firefox, which will allow you to open those MHT files on Firefox.
The only tricky thing being having no internet access at home. It's difficult to install MHT.
You could download that extension to your USB stick. It starts to get a little bit tricky there. Well, the idea of trying to open a file from a USB stick and it showing the running terminal is because, quite a geeky moment coming up here, but the file system that the FAT16 file system the USB sticks run on doesn't support all of the Unix-type semantics, so we can't, on a normal file system, we can identify files that are executable and that aren't. Whereas on a USB stick, they all appear as if they're executable. So that's why you're getting that prompt.
Oh, I see. Because under normal circumstances, you double-click a file and it opens with the associated application.
Exactly.
But this is saying, hang on, this file is executable. I'll try and run it. Do you want to run it or are you sure you want to run it?
And it's opening an MHT file in a text editor, basically, because it doesn't know to associate that with a browser.
And that's why he's seeing
code. That's why he's seeing the code.
Right.
Wow. The page HTML. So the screenshots.
Good, we've got him on the show.
Wow. We should have like a Tony surgery. Ask Tony.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea.
So right. Send in your problems.
Well, if you've got any questions for Tony, if you want to ask Tony, just leave us a voicemail.
You're going to do a jingle for next time, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Or if you have a jingle you'd like to send us for Ask Tony, then please do so.
You can sing it down the voicemail. And that's all your feedback.
You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers.
0203-298-1600.
You didn't sing it.
No, I didn't. There's no chance I'm going to sing it. That's going to be awful. 0203-298-1600.
Brilliant.
And Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show, or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yep.
Bye.
Ta-ra. Bye-bye.
Thank you.